Welcome to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 97 FM. I'm your host this week, Avi Marr. Lynn Steger Strong is the author of Want and Hold Still. Her nonfiction has appeared in the New York Times, Time, Harper's Bazaar, Los Angeles Times, The Paris Review, The Cut, New York Magazine, and elsewhere. She teaches writing at Catapult and Columbia University. Her latest novel is Flight. Welcome to Between the Covers, Lynn Steger Strong.
Thank you so much for having me.
So just to start out with, how did the seed of this book, Flight, start?
This book started in a way that no book or anything has ever started for me, which is to say I knew the end almost from the beginning. Huh. And I knew that the end would be I knew that connected to the end, there were two sort of dueling or interesting images and ideas that were important to me, which was there is one character in the novel building an installation of a flock of birds, an art installation, and there's another character building an igloo. And I knew the book would both start and end with those two objects. And I'm sort of obsessed with this idea of a container. And so that functioned as my container. And then I'll also say that I started with the image of the end, but I started not totally buying that I could feel the impact of the end. You know, a good amount of writing the book was that I wanted to write the book in a way that when I got to the end, I believed in it.
Yeah. So one of the themes of Flight is home and the idea of going home that's intensified by loss. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in South Florida, which is, it's a beautiful, magical place that I will probably never be able to live in. And I think that, you know, the book is about home and it's also about grief. And I think when I started it, I thought it was a particular type of grief that had to do with people. But I think through the process of writing it, and then actually we ended up, my husband's also from the town that I'm from. And during COVID, we ended up in our town for about 6 months. And that, I think, really crystallized for me the ways that it was also about grief around a place.
In what way?
I think we went to Florida. We love Florida, but maybe for obvious reasons and maybe not, it's not a place that I could raise my kids. I think the politics, I also just think, like, you know, hurricane insurance, like, it's just, you know, for lots of complicated reasons, we're not raising our children there. And I think spending those 6 months in Florida is one of those places, it's really, I think it's easy for a lot of people to disparage in certain ways, but it's also a beautiful place that's like no other place, you know? And so it's in my bones and it's in my husband's bones in this very specific way. And I think going there and getting to show our kids a little bit of what we loved about it was both such an incredible gift. And it was a reminder of the fact that we're not raising them with those things. You know, we're not raising them going to spoil islands and going in the sort of bathtub of water that the ocean becomes in August, and, you know, like being so deeply comfortable with the ocean the way that we were, like all of these things that feel elemental, not only to me, but just sort of like part of how my husband and I found our way to each other. Our kids aren't going to have that, you know, and that's, it's totally fine. They're going to have lots of other things, but I do think it's an interesting thing to come up against and consider, especially within the context, maybe obviously, of climate and more broadly I think the grief that a lot of us experience just on a daily basis in terms of like, what of the natural world are we losing?
Could we read a bit?
Yeah. In Florida, as they'd driven back to the airport, after Tess had initiated both the rental and the transfer of the deed of the house, she had thought but hadn't said to Martin that maybe they were losing not just Helen, but this whole state that she had come to love, even as they'd all disparaged it all these years. The flatness in the scrub trees, the lushness still for stretches, cocoa plums, hydrangeas, azaleas, alamandas, bougainvilleas, none of which Tess would have known to name before Helen was hers. The long blocks of concrete pastels on US 1, the way the heat felt wet, but also not as bad as it did in New York because they had the sea breeze. The trips to the beach always after dinner, everybody up late swimming, the water almost always warm, the way the salt stuck to her skin. All those years telling Helen to just let it go, to come be with them, and then Tess feeling too like she wasn't ready. How strange it was to think of a place she'd never been for more than a few weeks as a thing that she had lost. Grief was new to Tess, still foreign. She knew what it was to live with lack, had built a whole life knowing well enough not to depend on other people. But she hadn't ever lost someone who'd given her so much. Sometimes on the train, a run, walking to the apartment, she gets teary thinking about Helen, about whatever she might have said when next she left a message on Tess's phone. Just as likely about politics as palaver about a plant that she was growing. Just as likely that she had talked to Martin and thought Colin needed to change teachers, thought maybe she could help. She thinks of all those times Helen had flown up to New York for a few days, putting the ticket on a credit card that often later Tess and Martin would pay off. Taking the children for a few hours on the weekend, baking with them, making all the dinners, Tess relieved and easy on the couch. She realizes now that living with lack does not prepare you for loss. Lack is an amorphous murk, difficult, unpleasant, but loss weighs more, has a shape and texture all its own. She knows she would be nice to Kate. She should be nice to Kate, who loved Helen more than anybody, who talked to her every day. Tess thinks now that she needs to talk to Kate to help her, but she feels so much less capable now that Helen isn't here.
Beautiful beginning. And it really captures what you were just speaking about like loving a place and the person being kind of fused with what losing Helen and losing Florida. You've moved around like through the pandemic and in multiple places. And you were a New Yorker.
Yeah, we were in New York for 11 years.
It sounds like for some of the same stressful reasons. How do you think that helped you investigate sort of coming the concerns of loss and home?
I mean, I think actually that the part that I just read about this idea of lack and loss became really important to me in terms of the ways that, you know, obviously a place is not the same as a person, but I think, you know, I'm always interested in sort of taking the idea and turning it upside down and kind of knocking it about for what I've missed or what might surprise me. And I think, you know, in the time that we were moving around a lot, we'd lived in New York a very, very long time. I mean, not very, very, you know, we'd lived in New York 11 years. We'd never been able to afford New York, but we were sort of clinging to it with everything that we had because it felt like it would be a huge loss. And it was. But I think the interesting thing about the grief of losing a place, and I think especially for me, like losing what really felt like the only community I had ever had and a community that meant a whole lot to me, was that loss is not the same as lack, you know, was that in all the ways that community had bolstered and held and supported me, I am still the person that was built by that community. And also, you know, I'm still in touch with the people that were most elemental to that community. I still go back to New York probably more than is reasonable, you know? And so I think, you know, there were all of these concrete things that happened to us during COVID. And I think this is probably true for a lot of people that on the surface sounded quite bad, you know, like, my husband, we lost our apartment. We had to leave the city. We, for a long time, our stuff was in storage and we were sort of moving around. But what's great about experiencing a thing is that you also see all the ways that there are surprises and gifts and good things inside of them, you know? And again, I think that it's sort of our job. It's your job as a writer. When you're living your life, you're living your life, you know? And I kind of reject the idea that like you're going through something terrible and somebody's in the corner going, well, at least you got something to write about, right? Like I'm not, that can be a really difficult thing to swallow when very difficult things are happening. But I also think the sort of writerly tendency to cast about inside of an experience for what is surprising about that experience can be useful, you know? And I think what was surprising and also heartening and comforting about our prolonged itinerance was, first of all, I think like the solidity of the foundation of our unit, you know, like we really like each other. So it was, you know, so it was, so like for a while, my kids and my husband and I were sharing a bedroom at his parents' house. We were staying in a 2-bedroom, 1-bath house with my husband's parents. So that was quite tight. But we also really like my husband's parents, you know, and like what actually an extraordinary thing, you know, to be so tight in a space with people you love that much at a time when so many people felt so alienated and alone. And so I think, you know, I started this book pre-COVID, and I started this book maybe always when I'm writing books, I'm trying to sort of throw the ball out somewhere further in the project than I've ever gotten in my life. And I think sort of the idea of family as a scary word instead of a comforting word would probably have been my go-to at various points in my life. And I think I really wanted to believe that that word had more solidity than I had thought. And I think through the process of writing this book, but also in all the ways that our family and friends and community really showed up for us, I think I did get a firmer sense of what that word can be worth.
I think that's a really beautiful sort of way of living your question about the comforting side rather than the provocative, more troubled side of the word family. It reminds me of the character Kate, because it feels like Kate's question is sort of, will I really even be okay without my mom?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think Kate, I love Kate. I mean, it's interesting. You spend so much time with characters, and it's worth saying that maybe it's worth saying that I think each character for me in this book started from a place of sort of, well, it started from a belief that I have that like most of the sort of prickly things in other people that drive us crazy because they're also inside of us. And then how to knock those ideas on their head. And I think that Kate to me is this sort of dogged maybe belief in the word family that's been like rocked to its core, you know, and I think that I, you know, certainly as a parent have a pretty dogged belief in the word family and a pretty like sometimes it feels almost shameful obsession and pleasure that I get from being a mother. And so I you know, I think if Kate inhabited that space, what I also wanted to do is let her feel like more than that, you know? And so she is a mom, and she is a mom who loves most of all being a mom, but also she loves most of all being a mom because of how much she loved her mom. Right. And I think like back to the word family, the thing that I'm interested in as a writer is sort of asking that by the end of the book, your relationship to certain words is more elastic than it was at the beginning. Right. And so the word family was obviously something I was trying to elasticize in different ways. And also to say, hey, each person in this book is inhabiting that word in different ways. Can they, by the end of the book, create a sort of version of that word that they all feel like they can fit inside of, you know? And then I think with the word mom, there's a sort of similar thing happening. Kate, I mean, I'm constantly interested in the ways our models haunt us, you know? And I think previous versions, I think when I was a lot younger writer, I thought you only got haunted by your models if your models weren't great. But I think the thing that I've been thinking about more and more is it doesn't matter what your models were. They, you know, like the quality of your model doesn't matter as much as the fact that it will haunt you regardless, you know? And when your model is not as great, you have a really useful what not to do list. And what your model is great, you have a really useful what to do list. But then there's still all this other stuff you have to figure out how to do, you know? And so again, I think like Kate is sort of interesting to me because she's kind of counter to a lot of characters I've written in the past. And she's counter to the other women in the book, right? Everyone else has a sort of lesser model than Kate has. But I also think having an extraordinary model can be its own sort of challenge that you have to overcome.
Well, I also think it's part of what I adore about your writing is I think the other thing about what makes things haunt you that I thought as you were speaking about was when the writer removes judgment of that person's way of being, that especially the ways that bother other people, that's when I think it reaches a level where it gets into you as a reader. Like if you don't want to like a Tess or if you don't want to like a Kate, you are made helpless when it's written well enough by you. And that's what I think is one of the things that makes me fangirl out on you is you absolutely, you can feel it. And that I feel like I'm feeling the writer in that moment, like not judging these characters. I think that's the other way that we can inhabit them more deeply as a reader and get infiltrated by them.
Well, that's incredibly kind. I think, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you and I were talking before about students and I think, you know, I think this is true in writing, but I think in some ways it's easier to be generous to a character on a page than it is to be generous to a person who's in front of you sometimes, you know? And I think the wonderful gift of having been a teacher for a really long time is that if you spend enough time with a student or a human, you know, but the good thing about students is that you have to, right? Like you have to keep coming to spend time with students, right? If at a certain point you're a grown-up and you get to choose who you spend time with in other situations, but with students, you just have to keep showing up. And the thing that's sort of extraordinary about that is that I feel like if you just pay enough attention for a long enough period of time with any human, you might not necessarily love them, right? Like you might not necessarily fall in love with them, but they will surprise you enough that it will be charming because you will be like, right. You too are a person. You too are like significantly more than whatever knee-jerk reaction or judgment I made at first, which like I am very good at those, right? but then also the thing about being very good at those is that I have been continually knocked back down when those judgments have been proven wrong. And that has always been kind of not only like illuminating, but like very exciting to me, you know? And I think so much of the fiction that works for me comes from spaces of surprise. Mm-hmm. And I think it also comes from spaces of sort of asking the reader not, you know, like destabilizing the reader sufficiently that they're not able to land in spaces of good or bad or like or dislike, or I'm on team Tess and I'm not on team Josh or whatever, you know? And so again, I think to some extent, and to some extent, the process of writing this book was always over a very short period of time. And again, I knew the ending from the beginning. So I had a draft pretty quickly, but it was really just spending years going back through with these people and just letting them surprise me, right? Like looking for the little thing. Like at one point I was like, I realized that Josh had long hair and I was sort of like, why did I give him long hair? And then it turned into a useful way to me like, oh no, he goes to concert, right? Like it let me thread Josh through and make him feel more like a person. And I think I'm not really of the opinion that writing is magic. Like, I think that's sort of dangerous because I think people can do it. And to some extent, it's just work. But I think some of the work is going back into what you've already made and kind of mining it for parts.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. One of the other dimensions that you write so beautifully about is economic class. And you presented that at such great angles from these different characters with who we're talking about. Tess is a breadwinner. Alice was able to be an artist by coming from money. Kate's married to a guy who has trust fund. As you created the characters and followed the threads of their relationship to money, what surprised you most?
You know, I think it's not dissimilar from the thing I said earlier about Kate and her mom, right? Which is to say that money's, in my experience, money is complicated for everybody, right? And people who don't have a lot of money feel shame about it. And people who do have a lot of money feel shame about it. And people who got their money in ways that they don't want to talk about feel shame about, you know? And so it's just like, money's complicated, right? And insofar as like part of fiction writing is identifying objects and spaces where characters' kind of conflicting points of views and wants and fears all come into a direct conflict with one another, money just feels sort of endlessly interesting to me, you know? And again, I think this idea of like judgment and surprise, I kind of knew going in that the characters on either end of the spectrum, right? Because we have to sort of loop in Quinn too, but the characters on either end of the spectrum, the characters who doesn't have money and the character who's always had money are kind of equally uncomfortable, you know? And then as you work your way in, okay, so Tess has more agency around money, but that agency also feels like a trap, right? It's it, another way to say this is that like, I'm a sort of very firm believer in the idea that like nearly every feeling contains its opposite inside it too, you know? And so like, yes, Josh has a trust fund. What an incredible gift. Josh has a trust fund. He feels almost no power at all, right? Because that's what gifts feel like, right? Tess is an extraordinary provider. What an incredible gift. Tess feels like if she stops working, even for a second, she might die, you know? And so I think just like navigating, I mean, first to that initial point of like acknowledging that wherever you are, you feel a complicated, shameful thing. And then thinking about that thing and then thinking about that thing's opposite, right? And then asking the characters to inhabit. Because if I made the trust fund kid into just victim, that's actually not interesting, right? Because it's also like, I don't know, I would be, if somebody wants to give me a trust fund, I'm for it, right? But like, but nothing comes without complexity because we're people.
The feel of the book had this kind of, the way I thought of it was just like this underlying hum of anxiety that goes through every character, the direction from which it comes around money, but they're all so tense, yeah. It, from one direction or another. I just think that's very specific to you, that you really generously like provided that feeling as a surround to all the events that happen. So.
Oh, that's very nice. I do think to some extent, I'm like, yes, I also live with a low thrum of anxiety that sometimes gets quite loud. But yeah, I do, you know, I think one thing that was really exciting about this book, about writing this book in the wake of writing a very tight first person, is the tight first person was this attempt to get the reader inside of this very specific, rickety, anxious mind and then ask them to stay there. But I think what felt exciting about this book was acknowledging that being a person is a rickety, anxious experience, you know, and so allowing the reader to acknowledge that that lives in almost everyone, just in very different ways.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like that was part of the, I think what I want to do next is, and do sort of interior of multiple characters in a different way?
I mean, I think I'm really, what's feels really exciting to me when I'm thinking about a new book is the formal and structural exercises, right? Like I'm sort of the opinion that most writers are writing the same obsessions over and over and over again. And I also know, at least for myself, like you can't beat the me out of me. Like, I'm just going to keep writing the things that I'm always writing about. And so to my mind, like, the fun of thinking about a new novel is what's the new cliff that you're going to jump off of, you know? And so I definitely wanted a novel of the group. Like, I definitely wanted something polyphonic. It also felt sort of like a lot of stuff I was reading was first person. Like, I wanted something different. I was also reading right about the time I started this book. I had this kind of what felt at the time nearly transcendent experience of reading Mary Gabriel's Ninth Street Women about Lee Krasner and Grace Hartigan and Joan Mitchell and that sort of period of time in artists in New York, and just the incredible narrative texture that she got from telling all of those stories instead of just one. I was reading a ton of biographies then about artists. And again, most of them are so insular and specific. And this one just felt like it had this totally extra layer in life because it was the way the women knocked up against one another. There's a lot of stuff in that book too about class, because some of the women came from money, some didn't come from money, et cetera. And so I definitely wanted to write a book about a group. But then I think the other side of that is, it's to me, one of the most important things when I start a novel is that I have to have very clear constraints in order to feel sort of free to do what I want to do. So I knew I wanted a group, but I also knew the book would be very, very tight in terms of its timeline. Like, I knew it would be 3 days. I knew it would mostly be in the one house. And I sort of needed those two criteria going in and then figuring it out.
To have that many moving pieces, you had to have
that.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Our guest today is the novelist Lynn Steger Strong.
I also love reading your articles. And one of the ones that I adored was, I felt like you were the only person who talked about this, was that when you wrote the article about the dirty little secret of getting published being money. But no one talks about that, really, to have the time and space to get published and to really achieve what your dreams are, there needs to be someone funding it. And I thought that, one, I just want to thank you for being the person who said that. It doesn't get talked about. Why do you think that is?
I mean, it's, in some ways, it goes back to what we were just talking about money, which is, I think, first, it's shame, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that we all have so much, we have shame around our need for money. We have shame around our want for money. You know, like, in grad school, I felt insane for a good amount of it because I was like, why? I went to Columbia. I loved so much about my time there. And also I was sort of like, why is no one talking to us about how we're going to live? Mm-hmm. And I also felt embarrassed by that because what I was told was we were there to talk about the art. And what's interesting about teaching in that same graduate program and in other graduate programs is, first, I think we need to talk more about money, and I will continue to try to talk about money. And I also think one of the reasons we were talking about art is because, at least when I'm teaching at Columbia, I don't know how to talk about money because I still don't know how I'm going to survive. You know, like, I'm still sort of going from book to book and job to job. I still don't have a full-time job, you know, like all of these things. I think it's a long-winded way of saying, I think I'm much easier in retrospect, I'm not as cranky at my specific professors, because I think a lot of the reason my specific professors didn't talk about money is because they didn't have any answers. It's endlessly complicated, right? Which again is why money is so narratively interesting. But it's like, I think first of all, there are people who feel shame because they're not supporting themselves. Right. So their partner has a good job and their partner has their health insurance and their part. And so that comes with its own type of shame. It is a privilege, but it's also a complicated thing to talk about. Add to that, if you're a woman, and the sort of odd gendered feeling of like, oh, my husband's job, right? Like, I have plenty of friends whose husband's jobs support their families. that in no way undermines the value of their art or the value of their humanity, it's still a complicated thing to talk about out loud, you know? And then I think by contrast, like I have for long portions of our lives, I have been our primary provider. And the particular type of desperation I feel in my body when I think about selling something or getting a job also feels embarrassing, right? Like, and I know enough about art to know that art and capital don't mix. But I also know enough about life to know that I have to have a relationship to capital, right? And so I think part of it is it's so messy, right? It's so messy. And the minute you say anything, right? The minute you say, well, actually, I need my work to make money, people want to slap you back down in some way. And I mean, not to like get too complicated about this, but I also think people want to slap you back down because of their own stuff around money, right? Because if you say, well, actually, hard work doesn't add up to wealth, right? Then anybody who has wealth is upset because they worked hard and they got wealth, right? Mm-hmm. And if you say, well, actually, I need my work to have financial value to my family, anyone whose work does not have financial value thinks you're talking about them, right? And saying that so it's just, it's back to this idea of like those things that we hate about other people actually have to do with us. I just feel like our triggers are so sort of fine grain around money. And so nobody talks about it. But to your point, like, I don't know any other way to make it feel less shameful than if we talk about it.
You know, trying to say, this is important. This is who I am. This is what I want to do. I hear what you're saying about, I guess it's which people are going to slap you is the question.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but it's also like, I think part of it is that like, and I think maybe this is the gift of age, but I think some of it is just saying, well, actually I reject the premise, right? Because the idea, like I went to speak at a high school a month or two ago about my previous novel, Want. And in that novel, the woman makes choices that are explicitly bad for their family financially. And these students, and it was at a private school and they were lovely kids. And the students kept saying to me, she makes such bad choices. She makes such bad choices. And I was like, yeah, okay, sure, you guys. But first of all, people make bad choices. Second of all, you're defining bad choices based on the premises that on the premise that we should always value financial security and gain over all else. And I reject the premise, you know, like I reject the premise, you know, like there are things and this quickly, again, sounds like a Hallmark card, right? But there are things in life more valuable than capital. You know, and the idea that one make choices in order to create things that don't create capital is challenging because you have to live and you have to have food. Again, it very quickly gets complicated, right? Because yeah. Every time I say yeah. One of these things, there's this part of my brain that's like, right, like I say to you, I believe that there are things in life, there are pursuits in life more valuable than capital. And I believe that. But the minute I say that, my brain's like, yeah, but you gotta eat right. And you gotta survive.
Right. It's a privileged statement.
It's such a profoundly privileged statement. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I was telling my students, I'm teaching undergrads for the first time in a long time. In all the ways that over the past decade or so, I've been really sad and really angry about all of the ways art doesn't accomplish and isn't worth what I used to think it could accomplish and was worth. I think that I have also been continually sort of bolstered and surprised by the ways that it is still worth something, right? Like it's not everything, it's not gonna save anybody's life, but also that was never the directive for any single human to begin with, you know? And I do think, especially, you know, over these past few years when so much of life has felt alienating, art is intimacy. right? Like it's intimacy with another brain and another consciousness and another way of being. And like to have had access to intimacy has felt extraordinary, you know? And so that's something.
Your way is the best way to say it is to reject the premise as though they're in competition with each other, yeah. Rather than it's necessary, it's not sufficient, but to be able to pour yourself into a different life and have another life pour into you and be fed by that and be able to experience that, it has its own value. It can't be monetized in a certain way. So I appreciate the way that you're approaching that it's not an answerable question.
Well, and also capital is also insufficient. You know what I mean? Like capital is also insufficient. Like if you have built a whole life around your big empty house, you know, that is also, I would argue, an insufficient way of being in the world. You know, so both are, again, to my mind, capital is necessary, but art is also necessary. And so the idea that one must constantly think about one in opposition to the other, it just doesn't equate. Oh, yeah. It doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Another article you wrote that I loved. Well, I think we're in the same kind of wheelhouse around it, but kind of approaching it from gender perspective. Also, I loved the article you wrote about reading Rachel Cusk and Carl Nausgaard.
Yeah.
And about the different reception of women writers writing honestly about their personal lives versus men, and how one is lauded as an artist first, and the subject really doesn't matter that much. But with women, words like narcissistic, toxic, whiny, and the one I would like to add to it is confessional. I think it's another sort of backhanded compliment that gets attached. Yeah. Do you think that's changed at all between your...
You know, I think it's changed in the sense of there are a lot more women writing about women writing, you know, but I also think maybe it's back to this idea of the paradigm or the premise, right? Which is to say, like, first of all, I do not think women, and I would include myself in this category, are excluded at all from internalizing misogyny, right? So I think that like female critics, female writers, female people on the Goodreads, right? All of us hold our own expectations and ideas about woman, what a woman can or should do. And all of us have these sort of, I think, knee-jerk reactions to want to define and categorize the female in a way that with the male we're much less, we tend to do, I think, much less. So I think absolutely it's changing. I think even looking at Rachel Cusk, whom to me is such an extraordinary genius, but also had been a genius writing incredible work for a long time, but only got a foothold in a major way when she started writing fiction that is largely absenced of feeling. And I think that if you track through the female writers who are most successful and most sort of lauded on their own terms, there's often something. And again, this is tricky because like I respect and admire a good amount of them. There's often something that is particularly pleasing to the male gaze that doesn't hurt for them to possess, right? So whether that be like a brilliant woman, cold as ice, not totally invested in the other aspects of her humanity, whether that be a gorgeous 23-year-old exploring her sexuality, right? Again, like, books that I love in all directions, right? But like the books that the male gaze is willing or the critical world is willing to hold at the same level as books by men of all sorts of types, right? There is this part of me that looks at those books and is like, you know, like
there a theme?
Yeah, like there is what is the difference between books X, Y, and Z and these other books that I would argue are just as brilliant? Oftentimes it comes down to which is less upsetting or abhorrent or uncomfortable for, and when I say the male gaze, again, I don't mean men, right? Because I think that, like, I have been trained to view things from the male gaze as well. I have been trained to think that a beautiful woman has more power than a not beautiful woman. I have been trained to think that emotions are bad and we should stay away from them. I have been trained to think that intellect lurks a certain type of way, right? So when I say the male gaze, I mean myself too, right? And so I think, like, that paradigm shift, similar to capitalism, it's more complicated. I mean, artists have been railing about capitalism since the beginning of time, right? But we still don't know what to do with it.
Back to your book itself, in listening to you talk in other interviews about how your book, how Flight is being classified, I'm listening to that very consideration about, is it a domestic drama? And it really raised the topic for me about, if the art is about intimate relationships, right? Specifically written by women, is it going to be condescended to? Is it going to be sort of written off or put into a certain category? What are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think it's so hard when it's your own work, because I think that I have, like, a particular tendency to feel, I think I walk around, and this is just, like, my own pathology, maybe. But I think a lot of writers walk around with this combination of, like, extraordinary hubris and extraordinary shame, mm-hmm. around that hubris. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, I have a particularly fine ear for moments that feel like someone telling me to sit back down. And someone telling me, okay, sure, that's sweet, but please, over there, you know? And I think that part of me is like, okay, that's right. You know, like, that's right. That's what I deserve. Yeah. Like, I am, you know, who am I, this silly lady, you know, in my house with my stuffed Virginia Woolf? Like, you know, like, who am I? I should sit back down, right? But then part of me is like, no, you know, like, all of the language of books that are serious and important and big and great, right? Like, I want it for, I think, you know, it's worth admitting, like, I want it for myself, but I want it for intimacy, interpersonal relationships, family, trying to live and support yourself and love other people are serious and important and big and great to me. And I want the ways that certain bits of language, like quiet, and I think especially, like, to me, like, there was one piece about my book that was so nice. It was very nice. And my poor daughter was in the car with me, and I was, like, so mad. And I was just, because it said something to the effects of, like, a lovely book about mothers and motherhood. And I love being a mother. And I think motherhood is endlessly fascinating. And it also felt like a death knell, you know? And it felt like a sort of, oh, yes, nice lady, go sit over there, you know? And again, I don't have an answer to any of these questions. And maybe it comes back to the previous question, which is, one of the reasons it felt like a death knell is because I have been taught the male gaze, right? And if I were to say, it's like that moment when you go somewhere and a man says to you, somehow someone finds out what you do for your job, and they say, oh, I'm going to tell my wife about your books, right? And it's the same, it's like, oh, okay. Because being a person in the world and the complexity of it and all of that, like, that's not relevant to you. That might be relevant to your wife. To me, the human, right, absence of all of this societal stuff, motherhood is like this just extraordinary narrative terrain to explore, right? Like nursing is like an endlessly useful tool of narration. Children provide so much texture and complexity and like immediately up the narrative stakes, right? Like if I'm just a writer sitting alone in my room, of course I'm going to give these people children a good amount of the time because children help move the plot. You know, like children are useful to me as a writer, right? Children, knowing my children has been useful to me as a writer. But even what you're saying, like that feels sort of monstrous, right? Like, oh, I'm using children, right? It's like, well, of course I'm a writer. I'm using everything. You know, why would you not use motherhood? But the reason you wouldn't use motherhood is because the reason you say the word mother, right? Like I was at the airport not too long ago and something happened and I sort of said to the guy in front of me, oh, I'm a mom. Because I knew when I said, oh, I'm a mom, I would like make sense to him. And, you know, and he would like smile at me in this knowing way and we would be sort of buds in this way. And it was fine. And that at that moment, it's nice, right? Because I defined myself for him and then we carried on our merry way. But it was a sort of course, when you name yourself as one thing, you're doing a kind of violence to all the other things you are, right? And so when you name my book as a book about motherhood, you're not letting it be all of the other things that it is, right? And I understand it's a very human desire to want to categorize things, but it does feel like that desire to categorize is much more alive when the work is built by someone who identifies as female than it is by someone who identifies as male.
I mean, I like the point that you're making about it occurs unconsciously almost, you know,
yeah.
Before someone decides if they're going to take this novel seriously, which has 17 dimensions to it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Are they going to consider the dimensions about climate disaster? Are they going to consider the dimensions about how do you care for one generation while you know your generation is part of what ruined the world they're going to inherit, you know? Nothing light about that. It's not cute. You know, there's very deep questions, and whether they'll even be considered deep questions. That's what I love about what you're saying is it's an internalized system of sort of what gets considered art and what gets considered cute and what gets considered worthy of being gazed at. I mean, I think that's what I liked about that article was that my struggle was looked at as a writer's struggle. And secondly, was he becomes a father as part of it. Whereas with Rachel Cusk, it was, how dare you? I mean, I think that was basically the reaction to her memoir, right? How dare you be honest about how you actually felt? Like there was some trespass or something.
Yeah, no, Yeah, speaking of all of this, but yeah, it's so hard because I also think it is really hard to talk about books. Like as someone who's been writing a bit more criticism in the past couple of years, I think that we're constantly trying to figure out how to talk about books, and books are a sort of performance, right? And so I think like one of the ways that I think about how my particular personality is transmuted through my novels is that there's a part of me that doesn't want to take up too much of your time. So I am really invested in my novels being very short. And I've always been invested in that. And I also take a lot of pride in it, right? Like I take a lot of pride in the fact that like, I want the sentences to be sharper. I want the scenes to be tighter. I want there to be a feel like movement. Like when I'm inside of the craft of making the book, it feels like a strength. Right. But then when I read a lot of books that are considered important, there's so much sag, right? Like they're actually like, I think it's to their detriment, they're bombastic to a fault, but that bombast, they still get credit for the bombast because they're getting credit for sort of reaching for something big. Right. But it's like, no, I'm also reaching for something big. I'm just trying to get rid of the fat because that's for me. That's not for you, right? I'm not going to make you read 100 pages in the middle to prove to you that I read 30 books about birds and climate to write this book. That's my work. That's not your work, right? Mm-hmm. And again, I'm proud of that. I'm glad about that, And yet when I see the reception to other books and to my work, I'm like, should I have put that in? You know, like, should I have? And my answer is no. But like, there is this part of me that's like, what is it we're performing? Right? Like, are we performing to prove ourselves as thinkers or writers? Or are we performing to create an object that's the best version of itself? Right? And I would argue, like, my work at its best has nothing to do with me. Right? Like, it's a process of, it starts with me, right? Like, it starts with something like icky and mushy and complicated inside of me. But in the process of making the book, it's stripping away the stuff that is just about me, because you don't need that. Right? Like, that's what I, so that has to go away. And it has to become this thing that can live wholly by itself without me. Right? But like, I think sometimes I read other books where it's like, oh no, I see the writer trying to prove something about themselves on the page, and I see it kind of working for them. And again, I'm not going to stop being myself. And I also don't begrudge any writer anything working for them, because it's hard.
Right. If they get away with it, it works.
Right. It's really hard to get any kind of traction in this whole thing, you know? So like, I don't begrudge them that, but it is interesting, because to me, so much of making a good book is getting rid of that stuff.
It's such a cool thought that you're bringing up, because it brings us back to another thought that you were saying before, is who are you writing it for? I mean, in a way, who are you in dialogue with? Like, if this is a dance, who are you in dialogue with? And I hear you in dialogue with yourself about, I know what has to do with me getting the depth of this voice I want to bring forward. But once I get the depth of that voice, cut the rest away. And someone else might be speaking to some dudes talking to each other, which is somehow, sometimes when I'm reading, I'm like, I think I know who this is a love letter from and to, and it's not me.
Yeah.
And it's not to put it down there. It's still beautiful work, but.
No, it's just, it's different, you know, and it's different. And it's, there's two, I feel like there's two things here, and it's, both of these are things by a very beloved, very wonderful friend of mine. And the one is that she's an attorney, and she's a managing attorney. And we were talking about something in her job as a manager. And we were talking about sort of people telling us to act like a man or do X like a man. And she was like, you know, I think actually I'm going to manage as a woman. Like, she works with, she gets asylum for people who are seeking asylum, mostly from El Salvador. And so they deal with a lot of trauma, et cetera. And so she was like, actually, now I have this power as a manager, I'm interested in creating some trauma training. I'm interested, right? Like, I'm interested in creating different types of spaces. Like the idea that now that I have power, I'm going to enact power in the ways that I've been taught power could be enacted. Again, that doesn't actually work for me, right? And I think the fun thing about like writing criticism is saying, no, I know if you're talking for that guy's going to give you a gold star, but I'm not that guy. So I'm going to talk for this other type of reader, and that's fine. And also all of these readers can exist, right? And the other thing that my friend, again, one of the wisest people I know, when my first book came out and nobody bought my first book, it was just generally a big failure. And at one point she and I were on the phone and she was like, okay, sure. But somewhere right now, somebody is doing that thing with your book that you have done with books your entire life. And you know how good that feels to you? You're doing that to somebody, your book, your little book that like nobody's buying, but those seven people who bought it, it's doing something for them. And that will never stop being cool. And it hasn't, it doesn't, it isn't, you know, like, and that is, I think, who I'm writing for, right? Like every once in a while, like a couple weeks before Flight came out, I was cranky about some random, you know, publicity thing that didn't work out. And I was stomping around the house, I think being cranky. And then I got an email from a teacher, I love teachers, who had just read my previous novel, Want. And it was this just extraordinarily generous, thoughtful, wonderful email from a human being who felt something when she read my book, you know, and like my family has to live, success, money, blah, blah, all of that matters. But like, I don't write, I write for that woman who wrote me that email before she went to her job because the book made her feel a thing, you know? And I think that that's also like, that's how you keep writing in all of those years when all the other stuff feels abstract or non-existent or impossible to accomplish.
I remember you used this phrase that you have positivity Teflon.
Yeah. Yes.
And I wonder if part of what you're speaking to is what gets through that Teflon is when a person comes to you in a really personal way like that, there's a way you're able to absorb the value of your service in bringing forward something painful and open and something that interests and obsesses you, that reaction in another person and being reached by that gets you out of the other kind of mind, the kind of writer mind. And what are the measures of whether I did something worthwhile?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it's like, I think that the mind, the competitive, ambitious mind, like, I think more and more that doesn't feel like my writer mind, you know, that feels like my capitalist mind or something, you know, because yeah, the writer mind is also the reader mind. I mean, we've now like created this whole complicated metaphor and I'm quite bad at them generally, but like the writer mind is also the reader mind. And I feel kind of endlessly fed and endlessly grateful for those emails or like text messages from friends, you know, like my friend, you know, like a friend finishes a book and the book and they text you in the middle of the night. And like, what's greater? What is cooler than that? That's so cool. And then what my capitalist brain would say is what's cooler than that is a movie deal that helps your family feel safe for 5 to 7 years, you know, but yes. Like, actually, no, you know, like I'll, it's fine. I'll figure it out. You know, like we'll figure it out because money disappears. And that feeling of like, no, actually I'm doing the thing that I spent my whole life wanting to do. And like from one human to another human, like something was felt. Like if you don't find a way to let that sit inside of your body for at least a little while, it'll be really hard to keep going.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Could we hear a little bit from your character who kind of embodies this, Alice?
Alice takes a long hot shower now that the house is still and quiet. She turns on the small space heater on her side of the bed, fists both her hands and rolls them along the edges of her hips. Her wrists still clench when she's tense, although she used to blame the painting, the ripping canvas, working. She misses having somewhere to put all the extra anxious, worn-out self that she still has. Her work now is more solid, like those years trying to have a baby had felt at first. It has clear, concrete goals, clear, concrete steps. The meetings, the court hearings, the protocols, and the people, just like the special foods, the yoga, the long walks. Lying on the bed and visualizing the healthy, forming fetus, hands flat on her stomach, deep breaths in for a count of 6, out a count of 8. But Art and Baby had also begun that last year to feel similar. Rules that felt specific and exact, but also made up. Trying to be precise, but precise like jumping off a cliff. Art was from the body while a baby would be of it. Art was mushy, murky, abstract while a baby would be solid. The obsession and compulsion were exactly like she'd always done them. But then all that time and work for nothing. In that way, too, it felt like art. She's most grateful for her job now because she doesn't have to deal with her own thoughts as often. sometimes those years of the failed art and the failed baby, her art was not a failure, Henry said, but no one gave about it. So what else could it have been? When she felt empty, awful, she thought of calling Helen. She thought of asking Helen to love her, make it better. But what a stupid, silly, childish thing to say, to ask. I do already, is what Helen would have said. What Alice wanted was someone to prove it to her, prove something irrevocable about her, say it in such a way that she could feel sure they would not take it back. Helen was the only one she might have trusted. Henry seemed to want her too unthinkingly to see how wanting wasn't loving. With every man who'd ever wanted her and called it love, she'd felt like this. This was true, too, in its way of how her mother loved her, preconditioned. The baby was something both Henry and her mother wanted that she couldn't give. Henry said he didn't. It was her choice, but she knew better. She thought maybe her body couldn't hold a baby because it understood she'd never really learned to love another person. Maybe also this was why her art failed. She'd not been shown or taught enough about just loving without first appealing or performing. This was her body's way of keeping all her future children safe. And then when she stopped working, and then with her new job and all the ways it shocked her, scared her, made her feel inadequate and helpless too, she'd never picked up the phone and called Helen, not with the art or with the babies, not this past year when her job got murky. It's a particular type of sad, she thinks, to miss the possibility that she might one day call this person who is gone now, that what she lost was a thing she never had the courage to go get. Well, that's very, I think I've said this in another, someone else asked me to read this passage and it means a lot to me because that there is nothing, of all the hours and days and weeks and years on this book, I think that those few paragraphs got their
That's
own
the kernel.
Torturous couple of weeks.
But in the face of what we're trying to create and can't create, and when we can't resolve it, that sort of desire to be taken in. I think it's what I love about your work. I feel like that's sort of like a nice symbol of the container that you provide is a sort of safe space to be held in the questions that can't be answered that I think you describe so beautifully, but at the same time kind of sit with in this kind of melancholy space. It's what just lovely.
That's so nice. It's interesting the word failure, right? Because like I think we're always failing as artists. And how great, right? Like I've spent the past, since the book came out, thinking in a really excited way about all the things Flight failed to do, because now I get to try to do them this time, right? And so I think like that's another space where art to me is a sort of solace and provides a sort of grace, right? Because the idea of failing in art actually feels thrilling. Right. Like, I know I'm going to fail. Like, I know, like I was telling my husband, like I'm far enough in this new book that I'm like so excited for what I know it can be, but I'm not far enough along that I don't also know all the ways it'll be less than what I hoped. Mm-hmm. Right. But I'll get there, you know, like it'll be less than what I hoped. And that's fine. Again, it's like, great. So next book, yay. Right. But then by contrast, like failure in life, like the idea of failing my children, like, but I'm going to, right? But like, I'm going to, but it's just, again, it's sort of like, failure is a word that capitalism and the paradigms and premises that I was brought up for with, there's nothing more abhorrent, you know, there's nothing more horrifying, but it's just life. Yeah, like it's just life, and it's rife with it, and we're all fine.
How you interpret that to mean, should I give up? I mean, that's what I loved about that section about Alice, that she's wrestling with that. You know, did she give up, or was it this, or you know, and how she moves forward and what she does to move forward? Because I think that's really heartening.
Yeah,
it becomes something that you can be excited to fail. And it doesn't mean anything about, you're just in it with the rest of us then. So keep swimming.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's, you know, I teach this class that your friend with that where people write full novels. And one of the things I force them to do before we get to the end is start their next book. Because I think that one of the things that stops people from finishing that first novel is they are asking the novel to contain everything they are as a writer and a person and everything inside. And that's not possible, right? Like novels are like tiny little things, you know? And so it's like, if you keep going back into that same novel and asking it to be everything, you'll never finish it, right? And also it will be a mess, right? But if you just say, oh no, actually, this is what this novel is. It's a very small thing. This is a novel. A matriarch dies and a little girl goes missing. It happens over 3 days. There's some families, you know, love, failure, blah, blah. That's this book. I'm going to write the crap. I'm going to write this book to the best of my ability. And then I'm going to take all my messy, complicated self and sense of myself as a writer. And I'm going to move it over to the next thing. And I'm going to get all that extra in that, try to get more of that extra in that next thing, right? And again, what a gift, right? Because who wants to write one book and call it a day? You know, like, but I do think with that first book, especially, there's so much the feeling of it has to contain everything, and that's not possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been so lovely to talk to you.
Oh, it's so good to talk to you. I'm so thrilled by, you know, it's always fun when it's another writer and it's also really like I said before, it never stops feeling special to be read so well and so thoughtfully.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this week's Between the Covers with me, your host, Avi Marr, with musical help from John Becht.